Hi everyone, welcome back to the podcast. I'm very pleased again today. I've noticed a theme with my podcast now. So I tend to have, firstly, friends. Secondly, people who have inspired me. So these are good reasons to have people on. But thirdly, it tends to be ex-colleagues from a company I worked for, EF. Today is another one of them. Fourthly, people who live in various exotic countries and have a very mixed background of different countries and different language skills. And again, my guest today meets all of those requirements. However, he does have some new and interesting things to talk about that haven't been talked about before on the podcast. So I hope you enjoy our conversation. It is Luca Marchiori. Luca is over in Italy, as his name might give away. He is a son of a British woman and an Italian man, I think, right?
Italian man, that's right.
Yes. Brought up across two cultures, completely Italian-ish and completely British-ish, if that's even a thing. So I'm going to pass over to Luca to explain a little bit about what you're doing and where you are in Italy, where you are in the world right now, and what you're doing. So Luca, you can take it away.
Hello. Well, thank you very much. After that introduction, I'm a little bit embarrassed because obviously it was very kind of you to say that you're inspired by your guests as well as anything else. But no, it's great to be here. We go back a long way. I count you as one of my closer friends who was also a colleague, which is really good. So yeah, as you said, my name's Luca Marchiori, and I'm half British, half Italian, as you can hear with my British accent here. I was born in Italy. My mother was an English teacher, in fact, which I later ended up doing. And so that's sort of a bit of a family profession. And she was living in Italy, met my father, got married, had kids. And then when I was about 2 or 3 years old, they decided that it was a good idea to go back to the UK. So I grew up and was completely educated in the UK and then moved back to Italy in adult life. But as you said, Nick, I always have lived across the two cultures. And so after spending a lot of time teaching English and then working in editorial positions connected with teaching English, I find myself finally now reverting back to my original, or to my lifelong passion, which as an Italian is hardly surprising, is food. I grew up in a very foodie household. My father was, being Italian, very into his food, but he also worked in the food industry in hotels and restaurants for all of his life. So I sort of grew up around that. One of his later positions was working in a Michelin star restaurant, and it was a very small restaurant, very close-knit group. So I got to meet and spend quite a lot of time with the chef. So I got to, you know, as a 13, 14 year old, I got to see into that world. And actually, I wanted to be a chef, but my father talked me out of it, having seen how hard it was and also the way it seems to take over your life. So I didn't do that. But now, as I said recently, I've come back to be interested in that, and a few years ago started a blog. And one of the things I noticed about Italy and about Britain is that a lot of British people completely misunderstood Italy based on the fact that they didn't really speak good Italian. And also a lot of Italian people completely misunderstood British culture or Anglo-Saxon culture based on the fact that they don't or didn't really speak very good English. The level of English in Italy is getting a lot better. So I found myself doing a lot of cultural interpretation as much as anything else because I understood both sides. And that's carried through to my blog now, where the idea of what I do and what I write about is translating Italian food for British and American people, for English native speakers, because the food in Italy is something which is quite misunderstood outside Italy, because both all English-speaking countries have expat communities of Italians who over the years have changed what they eat, either to produce things for the local taste or to produce things with the ingredients that they have there, rather than the things they'd be cooking back at home. And I find that that's what people think Italian food is, whereas actually the reality in Italy is quite different for various reasons. So that's the slant of what I do. And I've recently started a podcast on this and my other love, which is history. So I put the two together, and my podcast is about the history of Italian food. And so every week I take a dish, or I take an aspect or an ingredient of Italian food and trace the history of that through to the current day. So as I said, in adulthood, I moved back to Italy, and spend a lot of my time at the moment is spent in Rome, the capital city, which is not, which was quite a new thing for me. I was born in Venice, and growing up as a child, I spent a lot of time coming back and forward between England and Venice with my family. And then also Piemonte, which is where my uncle lived, which is on the other side of northern Italy. So until I was an adult, really, Italy for me was Venice and Piemonte. And it's such a rich country of differences that as soon as I ventured south of there, I discovered a completely different culture and completely different food than I was expecting. So I now travel around Italy as much as I can, investigating and highlighting differences and finding out about the local food and that kind of thing. But as I say, I spend a lot of my time in the beautiful eternal city of Rome, which has stolen my heart in the last few years and almost replaced Venice in my affections as the best city in Italy.
Oh, yeah. Nice. Well, I love Italy, so I'm not going to make any bones about this. I genuinely love it, and I particularly love Italian food. And I have to say, so the theme of the podcast is wind building, and you have got winds to talk about, but I also was kind of like, this is cool. I get to talk about Italian food and Italian lifestyle and learn a bit more about Italy. And I've spent a bit of time there myself. I worked with a team in Rome, actually, and also in Milan, funnily enough. Just beautiful people. Great energy. I love the energy of Italian people. It's such a they're such proud people, but kind of proud of their culture and their richness of culture, rather than proud of themselves, I think. And that's my impression, at least. So I really love that part of it. And of course, the food, what I see is in the food is that it seems to be relatively simple ingredients cooked really well and put together really well. So that's kind of, I guess, my simple taste. I love that aspect of Italian food. So before you do anything else, you probably should pause this podcast and go and subscribe to Luca's podcast, because it is awesome. And the episode that's just come out on margherita pizza or pizza is epic, and also the previous one on coffee was also brilliant. And he talked all about coffee and how espresso came around, and I cheekily wrote to Luca saying, are you sure it's not espresso? So we're going to get into that. Sure. We're also going to get into pineapple on pizza, because that's one of the few things I think Italians are getting wrong quite regularly. They don't seem to understand the beauty of pineapple on pizza.
It's funny, because there are a lot of Italian food rules which again, propagating these and emphasizing these, I think, is a little bit part of the Italian sense of humor as much as anything else.
Yeah.
Because they're not things that they take really seriously. They do take them seriously, but not really seriously. But I think they like to pretend to take them seriously because it amuses foreign people and also appeals to their sense of humor. I mean, one of the most famous ones is the fact that you can't drink milky coffee after 11 o'clock in the morning, which they love repeating this to people. And they will say things like, you know, I feel physically sick at the thoughts of drinking a cappuccino at midday. It just turns me off. But I'll happily govern one at 5 to 11. And so things like that. And so I think partly it's an Italian sense of humour. But the thing that I've discovered a lot is that also the rules are there to be broken. And Italian food is so varied and changes so much depending on which part of Italy you go to, for which there are very good historical reasons. Italy as a country has only existed since 1861. And before that, after the fall of the Roman Empire for over 1,000 years, Italy was a myriad of different states all with their own culture, own language, and own influences. And that is very much present in the cultures of the different regions today. But one of the most famous ones is, again, that you can't eat chicken with pasta. Chicken and pasta don't go together. So if you make chicken pasta sauce, no, Italians will not eat it. They will say, this is not Italian. This is not something that we will do. And I wrote a blog post about this as well, explaining why. I went and asked all my friends and everybody I knew, why can't you eat chicken with pasta? And a lot of them came up with the, well, because you can't argument, which is quite a good one. And then a few of them reasoned why, and I go through all this on my blog. But basically, it's just not the done thing. You do not eat chicken with pasta. And then a friend of mine who is from Calabria, well, she's American, but she's like me. She's got Italian heritage, and that heritage is from Calabria. And she found an authentic, traditional Calabrian recipe for pasta with chicken.
Oh, wow.
And it was like, well, there is one place in Italy where they will eat pasta with chicken. So I'm waiting to find the one town or region in Italy where they will put pineapple on the pizza. But as yes, I've not found it.
Certainly not in Naples. I can tell you that for free. No. I think it will be a long time before Naples gets on board with
it. Well, as you know from my podcast in Naples, they don't put anything on the pizza apart from tomato, garlic, cheese and oregano and basil, and that's it. And they're very strict about not putting anything else on their pizzas. However, there's a I have a house in Tuscany and in a little village, and there's a bar in that village that on Friday, Saturday and Sunday nights do pizza, and they have 100 different types of pizza on their menu, which goes through all the different gamuts of ingredients. So I have checked the menu and there is no pineapple even there. But
how disappointing. Even with 100 options, they can't put pineapple. Mm-hmm. Oh, no my pineapple. God. Come on. Mm. You should petition it for your friend.
But
Nick.
It's just that is just gross though, isn't it? Really?
So I travelled around Italy with an ex-girlfriend actually for 17 days, nearly 3 weeks after doing a ski season. We drove down through the middle, down through Montepulciano and Perugia, and it was a beautiful trip, and down we ended up on the Amalfi Coast, and we ate pizza 17 days in a row.
17
every single day we ate pizza for dinner, and then one day in the middle of that we ate it for breakfast and lunch as well because we had leftovers. Yeah, it was a epic trip, and I'm a big fan of pizza, but I do look back on it and think there are other really nice Italian foods that I could have eaten more of.
There's a lot of really nice Italian food that's not pizza, and in fact pizza is pizza is something which most Italians will view as a Sunday thing. There's in many parts of Italy there's a tradition to go out on Sunday nights with your family and have pizza, because it's whoever cooks in the household's night off. They've just cooked a big lunch, because Italians have a big Sunday lunch. So Italian pizza on a Sunday night with the family out is quite a tradition.
Yeah.
So once a week. But,
so Luca, let's move off of Italian. So Luca's blog and Luca's podcast, epic, and I love it, and I love what you're doing, and it's super interesting. And so you've got to hear more of Luca. They're nice bite-sized chunks. So I think the pizza margarita episode is like 15, 20 minutes, something like that. So it's beautiful listening to Luca talking about all the history and where it comes from. Please check that out. It's super cool. And obviously Luca's also got his blog and things. I'm more of a listener and a watcher of videos than I am of a reader of blogs, but I know a lot of people are into the blogs as well. So also Luca has his YouTube channel, which I'm also very familiar with. So check him out. But I want to get into you, Luca, and a bit about your history and background, because we are talking about wins, and I know you've had a very interesting life from an early age. You were I want you to start talking about it, but I also want to say the word ballet to make sure we cover it, because you were a ballet dancer back in long time ago.
For
so
many years.
Please, I'm making you sound very old. Sorry, not that long ago. Long enough ago that it was it feels like a while ago probably. Why don't you take us through a bit about that and how it was to be you as a young man, a ballet dancer, and where you were growing up at the time, and you know, talk me through that, because I think for me also talking about wins, constructing wins, competing in things like ballet and learning to be a competitor in, or at least learning to do something with finesse and perfection. There's a really interesting set of pieces that have to be put together to be able to do that. Not just the practicing, but also failing and not being able to do it and learning how to do it, all that kind of stuff. So that's also why I'm interested to hear about it. But I also want to know about your life. So tell us from the beginning.
Okay, so how do they get into ballet? That's a really good question. My parents were really good parents, I must say, and they wanted to give my brother and I all the opportunities that they never had as kids. I mean, my father was growing up in he's born in 1939, so he was growing up. He lived through the Second World War and was growing up in Italy in the aftermath of the Second World War, where nobody really had anything. And my mother was born in 42 as well, so she lived through her early years, lived through the Second World War and the aftermath in the UK, where there was all rationing and people didn't really have anything. So they had relatively deprived childhoods, and I think they wanted us to have every opportunity that they didn't have. So my parents used to take us everywhere for a start. So we traveled an awful lot with them. They'd take us out to restaurants, but they'd also take us to the theater and the cinema. And they both were really into ballet. And so I remember as a small child getting taken to the ballet a few times. And we lived in a lovely town called Bournemouth on the south coast of England, if anybody knows it. And there's a really good theatre there. And in those days, the Sadler's Wells Royal Ballet from London used to come down every year and do a season in Bournemouth, which seems now what seems a very unlikely thing. And we used to go and see them. And I remember just being completely captivated with it. And my parents wanted us to do sport. They wanted us to do music. So one day I said to them, I think I was about 8 years old or 7 or 8 years old, I want to do ballet. And my dad sort of tried to talk me out of it, I think, at first, for about half an hour. And then one evening, less than a week later, he came back one evening and said, oh, you're having your first ballet class next week, by the way. And he'd been out and researched all the schools in the area and chosen a school for me. And there it was. And I went off to a place called the Stage Door School of Dancing in Bournemouth. Shout out, because it's still there and it's still being run by the amazing Mrs. Maureen Hedford, who was my ballet teacher, who has not changed at all in all the time that that I've known her. She looks exactly the same now as the day when I first started. And I did that, and I loved it, and I got on really well with it. And there were about three boys in the school, and all the rest were girls. And Mrs. Hedford was great at teaching us, and I did all exams and things like that. And it came up to dominate my life because I hated sport. And I remember when I was about 14, I really hated games at school. We had to do compulsory sport for an hour and a half a week. And at one point I told the headmaster that I'd rather do ballet than football. And he said, well, if you can arrange if we can arrange it, you could go to do ballet classes instead of the football. That's great. And so I used to get an afternoon off school as well to go and do ballet classes, which was really good. And then I told my parents that it's something I really wanted to do professionally. And again, they did everything to try and dissuade me. They said, well, yeah, but you go to university first. It's like, you can't go to university first because you can't take up ballet at the age of 18. You need to do the serious training when you're 16, 17. And I said that there was this professional school called the Bush Davis School in East Grinstead, and one of my friends went there, and I decided that I really wanted to go there too. It was because it was the best all round dance school in Britain at the time. And if you went to, for example, the Royal Ballet School, you just did ballet. Whereas if you went to Bush Davis, you did other kinds of dancing, but you also did acting and singing and music. And I thought that was probably a better bet because that would prepare me to do more things professionally. And one day we were watching, there's a, Nick will know what this program, I think it's still on in the UK, called Blue Peter, program for kids. And one day Bush Davis came up on Blue Peter and they did a thing there. And my parents said, is that the school you're going to then? And I went, what? And they said, well, if you want, really want to, you can audition. So I auditioned and I got in and I went there. And I did 2 years professional training and school. It was my parents let me go there at the age of 16 on the one premise that I didn't give up my academic studies. So I had to do A-levels at the same time. And not a lot of people were doing that at Bush Davis. Most people were just doing dance in their final 2 years of school. So I used to have to get up at about 7 o'clock in the morning and do 2 hours of school from 8:30 till 10:30, and then do ballet from 10 or dance from 10:30 until about 7 o'clock in the evening every day. I remember the ballet head, the head of the ballet department saying, well, you have to work a lot harder if you're going to do these other things with great disdain. And so that was it. So, and I stayed there until I was 18 years old. Unfortunately, maybe it's my fault, the school closed down as I left. I was supposed to do 3 years there and I only did two because the school decided that it was going to close on its, I think it was its 60th anniversary. I think the owners had just sort of got tired and wanted to retire and didn't want the name to go to anybody else because it's their family name. So they closed the school and that was it. And it was at that point that I took the opportunity to go to university for various reasons and stopped dancing at that point. But there we go. So that was how I got into in the brief history of my time as a ballet dancer.
But that's incredible because I think I want to dig a little bit more there because obviously if you're training 2 years in that high level school, you know, the best school in the UK and things, you're so dedicated to the craft of, and I like hearing, and I would like to hear more about that teacher, the ballet teacher saying to you, you know, you're going to have to put more work in, because I think it's interesting choosing how to balance priorities and understanding what the priorities are. And something in winning and in being the best at something and achieving, you know, greatness or achieving the very top, the pinnacle of something, it involves sacrifice and it involves quite a lot of compromise on various things in your life. And I always find that interesting. Some people really want, you know, they want this so bad, but they're not necessarily willing to put the effort in to get it. And I think that's a really interesting challenge because for your sake, you know, you were clearly in it because you were in this best school, but then I think sensibly you were also putting in the hard work to study. And so you went to a good university, right? And you studied classics or?
I did. Yeah. I went to the University of Manchester.
Yeah.
And I studied, completely changing my lifestyle. I studied, basically ancient history and ancient and early modern history. Which was great. I added the early modern bit in because I wanted to study the history of Renaissance Venice, which was something very close to my heart. So I had to do, I basically did ancient history with a final year on Renaissance Venice, which didn't seem to match. But in those days, they were a lot stricter about what you could study at university. You couldn't mix and match, and you had to study the plans that they, and nowadays you hear people are doing all sorts of strange things like history of brewing and things like that. But in my day, just work wasn't possible. And I was lucky enough to be able to do that in some ways.
Yeah.
But
my day too, by the way, we're not that different in age, I think. So my day too, we had fairly strict courses. We were supposed to do, we're supposed to work really hard at. But no, I'm interested to know because I think there's something just to drop back into that ballet thing and to challenge you a little bit on it, because I know you, we actually worked really closely on a very cool project together, and God forbid anyone's listening to this who's seen it.
And this is where you discovered about the ballet.
This is where we got to know each other because we worked some long, long hours together, traveling around the UK doing random events and stuff, and got to know each other very well. And I think there's some incredibly embarrassing videos of me out there and potentially of you doing teaching some people how to, I don't know, put together beanbags or something ridiculous. Mm. but I think what I've noticed about you is you're very driven and you're extreme. You're very, very, what's the right way of saying it? Like you have an intense interest in knowledge and understanding. And, and I think you're personally, I think you're very, very smart in that, especially in that way. And obviously you've applied that in your university and your learnings and your academics. But I'm interested to know more about the ballet as well, because did you think you were managing to apply it? Clearly you were good, right? If you auditioned and got into the best school, clearly you were a good dancer.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, you know, it's at the time, of course, you never think you're good. And I mean, I always have these visions of this ridiculous, because I'm overweight now, a bit tubby. And I have visions when I think of myself of this, you know, sort of slightly tubby, overweight guy at the back of the class, struggling to keep up with the others. And then occasionally I see photographs of this thin person who was me at the ballet school, actually holding my own with everybody else, and which is quite interesting. And no, I mean, I think I did quite well. What did it for the ballet, though, was this thing. And this is very interesting, because this comes through to my whole philosophy of what winning really is and what your goals in life should be, and the goals that have always driven me, is that I found it too restrictive, because I like, as you say, I have this thirst for knowledge, which if I go to bed in the evening without having learnt something substantial that day, for me, the day's wasted. I'm always on the lookout for something new, something to learn. And I think when I tend to find things that I get very passionate about until I've got to the level where I feel I know enough about them, and then I develop a new passion. And I think that's what did it for the ballet in some ways. It was because it was too restrictive. Mm. I was very driven and I was very into dancing and I did work very hard. But then there were other things that it was restricting me from doing or from learning about. And that's why in the end I chose to stop and to go to university, having mastered dance quite well. It was funny during lockdown, last year, I was a bit worried about my fitness and I was putting on weight. And so everybody was starting to do, you know, online, videos with, instead of going to the gym, and I thought, well, I'd like to do that, but I don't like going to the gym and I don't like yoga classes that much. And I don't like sort of, what do you call it? I don't know, aerobics. So I found some ballet classes online. Wow. I thought, well, I'm going to try and do a ballet class. Yeah. And I found a couple of easy ones. They were too easy. And I thought, this is really amazing. I haven't danced properly for a long time and I'm finding these ballet classes too easy. And I've eventually found a professional class from one of the ballet, I think it was the Netherlands Ballet Company, were putting their class online. And I was doing that. And it was amazing that after all that time, I could still do quite tricky things. And I thought, well, actually, that probably says a lot about how good I was at the time as well, that you know, I'm still able to remember how to do these things. So but like I say, when I found, for me, winning is all about happiness. Winning is about the ability to do what makes you happy, and what makes me happy is learning lots of different things all the time. And so that's for me, if I learn something new every day, that's a big win for me. And because that makes me happy. And at the end of the day, that's for me what winning really means. And I know that's probably quite a different philosophy from what a lot of other people have. A lot of people just want to be the best. And maybe that's what makes them happy. But being the best doesn't make me happy. Having the opportunity to do what I want to do and to learn what I want to learn, that makes me happy. And so I think that was what was behind that.
Yeah, I love to hear that, Luca. And I just want to say, because this has been a really interesting project for me, and you know, obviously I'm enjoying doing the podcast, otherwise I would probably stop. And I really appreciate those people who have commented and, you know, have been supporting and listening. I mean, I'm amazed that people listen, to be quite honest. I'm like, I'm sort of a little bit stunned by it all, because I'm like, well, even some people listening to, you know, me talk a little bit, but I have managed to meet some interesting people in my life. And I do think it's an interesting topic, and I'm fascinated by it myself. But it's I just want to make sure everyone understands that, like, for me, it's not winning is not being the number one, is not being the Usain Bolt. I mean, he is a winner as well, but that's also most likely because that's what he's dedicated his life to doing, because he found he had a talent for running or whatever, or because he ended up in the stream of life where that became the you know, the thing that made him happy and that he enjoyed. And likewise, you know, I've interviewed artists, I've interviewed musicians and all sorts of different people within adventurers and things. And I think it is the happiness. It is about, I guess that's what I'm trying to achieve, is looking at, like, what does winning mean to you? And that is the first thing that you need to really understand when you're looking at winning, is like, what is the win? And I think in when you look at that, you need to understand, what is the game I'm in? If I'm talking about winning it, what is the game I'm in? And in the game of, you know, for you, like, I would say that something around learning and education and understanding and knowledge, you know, what is that? That's a game. And there doesn't have to be one winner. You know, there could be many winners. There could be loads of people who know all about Italian life and Italian, you know, culture and things. But you have a particularly deep interest in that, and you have something, you have a passion for it, and that comes through. And if you can find a way to live your life alongside that, then you're winning, like you say. If you're learning something new every day, then you're winning. And I love that sentiment. I think it's beautiful.
I mean, it's like you say. I mean, Usain Bolt is a winner, and I'm sure his winning makes him happy, because there are people for whom being the best at something really does make them happy. But not everybody can be the best, and not everybody finds happiness in being the best. I mean, I've seen a lot of people who were trying to be the best in again, this goes back to the ballet. There were a lot of people who I grew up with, who I danced with, who were trying to be the best because that's what they felt that people expected of them, not because that's what was going to make them happy. And some of these people were very good, but were never happy with the level they achieved, because they always felt that they should be better. And a lot of these people are now doing completely different, are very happy now doing completely different things, that they don't feel this external pressure to be the best in, but that make them happy. And I think a lot of people are like that. Not everybody, but a lot of people feel pressure to be the best in something because it's what their parents want, or it's because what their, I mean, I mentioned a couple of occasions where my parents subtly tried to dissuade me from doing the things that I wanted to do, just because I think they probably felt, okay, we ought to do this because, at the end of the day, you know, at least if it all goes wrong, at least we've done our best to try and get him to do something more sensible. But at the end of the day, I think they realize that you have to let people follow their dreams, because that's what makes them happy. But like I say, a lot of people were going through the motions of trying to be the best because they felt external pressure, because they felt that somehow if they weren't the best, they'd let other people down. And that's for me, that's one of the worst things that you could possibly feel, because the only person you're letting down there is really yourself, because you're sacrificing your happiness for the supposed happiness of others, which again, a lot of the time is actually in your mind. It's your perception of what you think your parents want. I mean, it's quite complicated, but like I say, everybody is different and everybody will have a different view of this. It's just realizing what your view is and what really drives you, and what will make you happy, I think is the important thing.
Because I agree.
At the end of the day, happiness is what we're all looking for.
Everyone having a different opinion or a different, I agree. There will be some people who have a different opinion, but ultimately it makes a lot of sense what you're saying. And following your dreams is a well, you know, is a very common, commonly said phrase nowadays. And in fact, in the last podcast, I said about the fact that I have a bit of an issue with the idea that we tell people you can be whatever you want to be. I think that's wrong, but I think the idea that you can chase your dreams and try and construct a life which involves the dreams you have and helps you to achieve the things that make you happy, that is absolutely achievable. And you can gear that up by having a growth mindset and taking positive steps towards that goal. But you can be anything you want to be. I just find that a really difficult pill to swallow, because I'm like, you can't be Usain Bolt. There's certain things which will get in the way of you being able to be whatever you want to be. You can't be Bill Gates, because there's only one Bill Gates, for example. You could be a tech billionaire of the future. You could be, but there's a whole load of things which are going to get in your way, which might be literally too much for you to be able to achieve that. And I think
I agree with you. And that idea that you can be anything, even if you can't, is something which will prevent you from being happy.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, when I say follow your dreams, I mean follow the way to your personal happiness rather than a dream. I mean, what is a dream? Is a dream something which is possible, or is a dream something which is not real and impossible? Follow your goals. Follow your happiness, maybe, is a better way of putting it.
I'm a coach and I believe in goals, but I think, and this again, we got into this in previous episodes, but I think it's really important to be clear on like what is a good goal? And a good goal is something that, I mean, there's the acronym SMART, right? I'm sure you're familiar with that, like specific, measurable, achievable, realistic, and time constrained. You know, like that is a SMART goal, and that is a very good way of defining what is a good goal. If it meets all those criteria, then it's a good goal. But yeah, like I want to be an astronaut, you know. It's like, okay, that's a goal. It's is it achievable for you in your life at that, you know, if I'm 43 years old, is it really achievable now for me to go and play professional football in the Premier League? You know, probably not at this stage. Realistically, you know, it's not realistic. And I think that's where people need to be honest. But again, is it my dream to play football the best possible level I can? Then if that's my dream and that's my, then I can make that a realistic goal by setting achievable targets. And I think that's, again, like understanding the game you're in and understanding what a win would mean to you is so important, because it's beautiful, you know, learning something new every day and then taking out, I assume you take time, because I know you, to appreciate those things, to be, you know, to understand what it is you've learned every day. And that is, that's great. Then you're winning. You're ticking a box in your head, even, or whatever, or on a piece of paper every day. And that's a great attitude.
I mean, for me, it actually ends up being quite easy to do, because I'm the sort of person that goes down rabbit holes. The internet was built for me, I must say. And when I was a kid, my parents, again, trying to give us the best of everything, invested in a hard paper copy of the Encyclopedia Britannica. And I used to do this thing where if I was watching TV and I heard about something and I thought, that's interesting, as the program was continuing, I'd go over to the shelf, get the relevant copy of a volume of the Encyclopedia Britannica and read up about that thing as they were going through. And often that would lead me to another part of the encyclopedia and another part and another part. And basically I was browsing the internet before it was even invented using the Encyclopedia Britannica. And so when the internet came along, that was obviously something that suited my way of learning very, very well. And so it's not easy, it's not hard to learn something new every day, because I have this way of jumping down rabbit holes, mostly through the internet. Now I sit watching TV with my laptop on my on my lap, doing the same thing, Googling stuff as and when it comes up. But
Wikipedia kind of crushed Encyclopedia Britannica. For those younger listeners, if there are any of you out there who have never heard what an encyclopedia is, let alone Encyclopedia Britannica.
We used to have something called books.
Yeah, it was a big deal back in our day. And we had one as well in our household. It was like a whole, like 20 books or something. It was extremely expensive. And it had more, basically all the knowledge of the world in a set of books, and it was not, you know, obviously it wasn't live like Wikipedia is and anything close.
I remember there were two levels. There was the first level, which was the brief summaries of things, and then there was another level. So there were like these 10 books at the beginning and then about another 20 afterwards. And you'd take the blue book first and you'd find the thing in the blue book. And then that would tell you what to look up in the brown book or the red book, in order to go into it in more detail. Or you could just stop there if that satisfied your knowledge. So it was all,
I can't remember what we had in case my mum ever listens to this. I'm sure we had both. I remember the blue one, but I can't.
Yeah, no, it was part of the thing.
but I think that thirst for knowledge and your sort of deep interest is what I think you also have a concentration level and your sort of personality as well. Would you say that has affected the way in which you've chased down, you know, your various paths in life that you've chosen?
Yeah, I mean, certainly it's, yes, I mean, I
introvert.
I get very enthusiastic about things. Sorry, I didn't hear that.
Are you an introvert or an extrovert? I'm
definitely an introvert.
I figure you're an introvert.
Which surprises a lot of people, because a lot of people will watch my videos or listen to the way I speak on my podcast or watch me teach. I used to be a teacher for many years, and I was a teacher trainer as well. And Nick knew me in my teacher trainer days, and you've seen me do presentations in front of 300 people without batting an eyelid. And I seem very, very extrovert, but I'm not. I'm the most introverted person I know. But I've developed, you know, you develop ways of coping with this, and you develop a persona that you use, in order to do these things. But yeah, I would say I'm very introverted. And when you see all these introvert memes, I go, I understand that.
Yes.
But I think that, I don't know, being an introvert means you are happy often to spend a lot of time just plowing through websites now, through books, and getting to the bottom of things. I do find it quite difficult to socialize, which I've developed ways of socializing now, and people go, you're really friendly and you're really easy to get on with, and apparently, but I think, well, that's something I've developed over the years. I would say I'm an introvert.
I think that's I've trained people in various different things, including some of these personality type indicator test things, you know, like Myers-Briggs and stuff. And I've trained sort of teams on that. And I find it fascinating that there's this divide between introvert and extrovert, and everyone always assumes they're either one or the other. But then there are certain people who are like quite extreme on one side or the other, and there are others somewhere in the middle. And everybody has something of a bit of both. You know, they have moments where, like, I'm an extreme extrovert. I'm not like, there's no big secret there, I don't think. However, I don't always love being around people, you know, and especially don't love being around crowds of people. And I like to have my space, you know, I really like to be able to kind of take some time to myself. So I definitely have those. I understand introversion from that perspective, but it does frustrate me. And I spent most of my life being one of these people. It frustrates me when I hear people making bold assumptions about introverts as though it's something negative. And I'm like, it is. Absolutely not something negative. If anything, like, I'm a bit jealous, because that's why I brought it up. One of the things I've noticed about a lot of my introverted friends is they're capable of so much in terms of concentrating. Like, they seem to have much better attention skills and being able to, like you said, delve into a book and, you know, like, go off in a rabbit hole on a book. Like, I don't know if it's, I mean, I'm pretty certain I have ADD or ADHD or whatever it is, and I'm not making light of that. I'm pretty certain I have some form of that. And so I have struggled with it in different ways, and I don't think all extroverts struggle with that. But certainly there's sort of, you know, this interest in the world around, like, you know, engaging with things and people around you is distracting. If you have a tendency towards that, it's distracting. So I'm always interested by that as well, that kind of like ability to concentrate so much and not, you know, not get such.
Do you know another way to another way that I develop my concentration skills, which I know is something you're going to go, oh wow, really, in a second, because like, this is something I've heard you talk about or mentioning in your podcast, is meditation.
Meditation. Okay, so now's the time to talk about my boss quickly. Ollie Christian, he, bless him, has listened to every single episode, and I can't believe it because I almost feel like I'm on show just for Ollie Christian. And he regularly says to me, Nick, have you started meditating yet? So once again, Ollie Christian, here I am. No, I haven't started meditating yet, but I will. So talk to me about your meditation. What do you use? How do you go about it?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm actually a practicing Buddhist.
And, oh, wow.
Practice of Buddhism is meditation. And So it's something I do on a regular basis. And but I find that obviously the main point of my meditation is not to become good at concentrating on things outside the meditation itself, but it really does help, and it really does change and improve your skills of concentration in other things, because you're developing the ability to just concentrate on one thing. Without to battle against your mind's tendency to dislike concentrating on one thing. So again, like I said, I don't meditate in order to concentrate. I meditate for other reasons connected with Buddhism, but it is something which I think can help a lot if you do find yourself finding it difficult to concentrate. And I think, I don't know if I find meditation pleasing, and I mean, I don't find it easy. Nobody finds it easy, but I can meditate. And I don't know if that's because I'm also good at concentrating, and I was good at concentrating first, and that feeds into the meditation, or whether the meditation, you know, is something which has helped the concentration. I mean, certainly I've been able to concentrate better on things longer than I've been meditating. Although who knows, maybe the concentration was a form of meditation that I didn't realize.
From what I understand about it, because I listen to quite a lot of people talking about this as well, and you know, it seems to be that there are like almost transcendent levels you can get to with meditation. So there's such extremes that people get to when they're just, you know, better and better at it and spend their lives doing it. So I am definitely I 100% believe in it. I guess you know, when we talk about, when you talk about happiness and winning, for me, I have to say, being a dad, and it not being the best dad, I mean, I joke about the being the best dad, but, and everyone likes to hear they're the best dad, you know,
sure,
but like,
sure, you're a pretty good dad.
The reality is, I take it very seriously. And, you know, although I'm a jokey, fun person, I take being a dad very seriously. And I really try and put the right energy into my kids, because I personally, I believe that's what you leave. That's what you leave behind. The challenge there is they're two young people who dominate every moment pretty much, so getting time to go and meditate is quite challenging at the moment, but I do find time
to meditate with you. How old are they?
5 and 2.
I mean, certainly the five-year-old certainly you could get the five-year-old interested in meditation as well, and meditate together.
So you know me as quite a bouncy, energetic person. I am nowhere close to my wife in level of energy and bounciness. So unfortunately, I think our kid has inherited that somewhat. But yes, we have done some yoga together, which is really fun, with this woman who does these like kids yoga thing, and it's great. So I agree, and we will get there. And I'm definitely not trying to make excuses. I think it's wonderful. But just quickly, I mean, we're going to wrap up soonish, but I didn't know that about you, practicing Buddhist. I actually thought you were quite a devout Roman Catholic. I remember talking to you about Roman Catholicism.
I grew up, I was brought up very, very much within the Roman Catholic faith, but for various reasons, it wasn't for me. And a while ago, probably when we were still in contact, I discovered Buddhism and then got more into it, and just found myself lucky enough to have access to some really amazing teachers within the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, but real Tibetan lamas who were in exile, left Tibet in the 50s and 60s with the Dalai Lama. And so yeah, and that was it. And that I found it a much more I found it a way of looking at the world and a way of analyzing the world and a way of appreciating the world and a way of accessing my spirituality that appealed more to me as a person than the Christianity did in the end. And but you know, that's not to say, of course, that Christianity isn't a way of doing that. I mean, the problem is, from my point of view, that there was one aspect to my personality which the Catholic tradition frowned upon, which is the fact that that I'm gay. And that was a gay person within the Catholic Church, particularly recently, just become so much about that that sort of takes over, and the spirit, the spirituality gets or the relationship with God sort of gets squeezed out a little bit by that. And so whereas in Buddhism it's not an issue at all, and in fact Buddhism accepts that that really there's no difference between anybody, whether particularly between male and female, but also between, you know, sort of people from different races, people from different outlooks, people from different sexualities. We're all the same at heart. And so I found that distraction not there, and I was able to get on with the idea of looking into the spiritual rather than the being distracted by the mundane, which unfortunately, as a gay person within Roman Catholicism, recently is something which just gets in the way.
Yeah, I probably shouldn't get started on my thoughts around all of that, because I probably will now end up, you know, upsetting people and getting onto touchy subjects and things. But I certainly have some strong opinions on that. But I am always amazed how. I think the one thing I can say without being too controversial is I'm always amazed how things like the Roman Catholic Church can sort of shoot themselves in the foot by kind of ostracizing people who are kind of like they want to be a part of it. And then you're like, well, if they want to be a part of it, why wouldn't you embrace them and just like find a way to join them in? Like, it's not like, you know, you have everyone in the world jumping at your doors now. So I'm always kind of amazed how religions don't adapt. Not that I think personally religions are such a great thing anyway, as they currently are. I think something like Buddhism is a way of life. And Christianity as well, for those that, you know, follow a lifestyle that is a Christian lifestyle and things, or any other religion really.
Buddhism teaches us to have the utmost respect for all spiritual paths and all religions, and I do, and I still have a great love and affection for the Roman Catholic Church, because it was my home. I was brought up in it, and I've met some amazingly wonderful saintly people within that organization as well. And but like I say, it's just for me, there was always that extra baggage just getting in the way and just distracting me from what was important, really, and you know, which in Buddhism isn't there.
I'm very glad you found that. I didn't know that about you, and that's a really interesting insight, actually. So that's a huge thing I've learned today, I would say. Okay, well, listen,
there's always something.
I obviously learned a lot, and Lucas, thank you so much for taking the time to come and talk with me. I want to reiterate to everybody to go and check out this podcast especially, but go and check out Lucas's website as well. So your website is Lucas Italy with no spaces, so and no hyphens, so lucasitaly.com, and I think from there you can find everything. You can find the podcast.
That's the hub for all the things I do. So on the menu you've got Listen, which takes you to the podcast. You've got Watch, which takes you to YouTube. So it's
a pretty good word. I think it's WordPress, isn't it? It's a pretty good website.
It is.
So, go check that out. I'll put it in the links below and things, but please do support him. And, he's reading out his, reviews on his podcast, each week. So I feel like maybe that's something I should do, because nobody yet has written a review for me. So, I've got to
get sure that will change.
I've got to make
sure
more of an effort
very, very soon. Okay, but if you're listening, review Nick's podcast now, especially this episode.
Listen, Luca, thank you. Sorry, it's great to see you, my friend, and I'm so sorry we can't connect in person. This bloody COVID thing is a pain in the butt.
I hope
your lifestyle in Italy gets a bit more normal. You were saying just before we started how it's a bit challenging at the moment because nothing's open, and I think there's a lot of people around the world feeling that. So let's all raise a glass and enjoy a moment together. And I tell you what, check out the episode on coffee, because for those of you who drink coffee, you're going
to
realize
it's short enough to listen to in your coffee break.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. That's true. And you'll realize you're drinking coffee wrong your whole life, which is, it's a little bit shameful.
I'm in the middle of making a little video to go on my vlogs, which ties in with that, because I talk about the different ways historically in which Italian people have made coffee at home. And I have the coffee machine that they used in the 19th century before the one that they have now, and I'm going to do a comparison of the two of them, which is going to be quite fun. So
awesome. All right, well, we've got that to look forward to. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. I hope you enjoyed it. Please leave some feedback if you've got feedback. I've got some more epic guests coming on. I've got more EF people coming on as well. Keep following us and keep listening out. Thank you so much, Luca. All the best to you, mate.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me. It's been really nice and really fun catching up with you again.
All right. Bye bye.
Bye bye.
All right. So I'll stop recording now. That's great, man.